Welcome to a short set of interviews carried out at the 2012 CAPE conference, Old Puzzles, New Pieces, Development Cooperation in Tomorrow's World, held on Wednesday the 14th and Thursday the 15th of November at the Overseas Development Institute in central London. You'll hear a short introductory conversation with Ed Hedger, the head of the Centre for Aid and Public Expenditure, and then a series of interviews with ODI experts and with external contributors, including the Managing Director of the World Bank, Sri Mulyani, the President of the World Resources Institute, Andrew Steer, and Nkosana Moyo, the founder of the Mandela Institute of Development Studies. We very much hope you enjoy these interviews. If you want any more information on the conference, that can be found at www.odi.org.uk/CAPE2012. Ed Hedger, head of the Centre for Aid and Public Expenditure here at ODI. Ed, this is the beginning of a series of interviews taken at the CAPE 2012 conference. Before people listen to those, can you give a bit of your vision for what you wanted people to explore at the conference?
Hi, Jonathan. The CAPE Conference 2012, we wanted to re-examine the role of development cooperation, to try and understand what we mean by that, who's involved in it, and what its purposes and objectives, the results we want to achieve from it are. We wanted to do that by looking at the contexts in which we're engaged, be they middle-income countries, fragile states, low-income countries. We wanted to think of the range, the constellation of different actors engaged in this. Traditional providers of ODA and development assistance, philanthropists and private givers, and the increased engagement of the private sector, for example, through impact investment and other modalities. By bringing these group of people together to look at the approaches and challenges of development cooperation, we wanted to ask a central question. Are the tools, are the flows, are the modalities fit for purpose in the current context of global development issues?
And reflecting on the conversations and contributions that you've heard over the last 2 days, what came as a surprise and what perhaps came as less a surprise, and who stood out for you?
The conversations on aid and middle-income countries were quite revealing to me. We tend to bundle South-South cooperation, middle-income countries and their role as receivers and providers of assistance as a homogenous group that all have similar motivations, all deliver in a similar way, and all have similar needs. That was revealed quite clearly to be not the case. Picking a speaker example, Li Xiaoyun, talking about Chinese aid, was quite specific in the roles and opportunities it presents, but was quite contrasting in his description of that, about the scale of flows compared to some of the smaller providers, such as Mexico and Brazil and South Africa, in terms of the scale of financing. The second point I would pick out would be the relationship between climate finance and ODA, official development assistance, as traditionally conceived. Andrew Steer, for example, laid down this question of whether this is a tension that we need to be concerned about, the total pot of public funds available from taxpayers, principally in rich countries, to grapple with these challenges of poverty reduction and climate preparedness and mitigation. Is it a zero-sum game? Are we trying to solve both sets of challenges from one pot? Or are there a set of connected challenges which can all be addressed through a similar amount of money?
The conference is over now. A lot of work goes into a conference like this, and you'll be looking at what work is to come. Where can people who are listening, whose thoughts are provoked by some of the interviews we're about to listen to, where can they go for more information about CAPE's work, and what can they expect from CAPE over the coming months?
At CAPE, we are committed to making this the start of a conversation, the start of a process, not the end. We've brought together some of the leading thinkers on the issues. We've hosted them at ODI for 2 days. That has helped us cut through a little bit of the rhetoric to get a little bit of the reality, but that's only the start. We want to move forward in two or three ways. First of all, picking up specific issues that flow out of this. We've talked about the climate finance agenda and its relationship with ODA. We've talked about philanthropy. There are questions about the scale, the focus of that, for example. We've surfaced in the final sessions of the conference the role of results-based aid and what that means. We want to now focus on developing the evidence base. So work will be coming out on all of those topics over the coming months on CAPE website. We also want to engage the broader conversation still. There is a an energy and a dynamism in that room, not just to talk but to act. We will be producing a conference report, of course, within the coming weeks, but also looking at ways that we can maintain a community of thinking, a community engagement around these evidence and policy issues. And more information on that coming through the report itself and linking into the CAPE website over the coming couple of weeks and months.
Ed, thank you very much. Sri Milyani, Managing Director at the World Bank. We're here at the CAPE Conference 2012, Old Puzzles and New Pieces, looking at development cooperation in tomorrow's world. You've just given the keynote speech and you talked about the rising number of middle-income countries in the world, many of them graduating from low-income status. What does the increase in the number of middle-income countries mean for aid and development cooperation?
Well, definitely in terms of the demand for development aid or cooperation, middle-income country graduated from low-income country doesn't mean that they overcome the development challenge. Even in this case, the number of poor in many middle-income countries there. But they also have their own resource. They also build their own capacity to address their own domestic. So the engagement and interaction with many of development agencies is need to be changed based on the development, the level of development that they are having. Addressing issue which is more on a second generation of reform, that is institutional capacity, addressing the issue of inequality, using their own resources much efficient, and that's we responded with innovation, for example, like P4R, the program for result, institutional building capacity and knowledge exchange. I think that is the area in which the demand from middle-income countries is very important. Why it is important? Because I think if middle-income country able to address their own development challenge, that will collectively help the global development goals.
Okay, and you talked about this middle-income trap where countries are then unable to graduate to high-income status. Mm-hmm. How can aid and development cooperation play a role in helping middle-income countries to continue to grow?
Well, the trap usually characterized by the change of or fail to change of the at the institutional level, whether this is related to their, for example, public finance, for example, revenue or tax, creating both the capable or effective public institution is very important. It is beyond just adopting a good policy or macroeconomic policy, sound macroeconomic policy to have a fiscal sustainability, but they really need to have the institution that will serve the need of public. And that is very urgent, and that creates a trap when you have a higher income per capita, but then this income per capita is not really reflecting the quality of life or quality as well as inequality. And that is something which I think many middle-income countries struggle. That's why how the international community and development cooperation can help. Usually in terms of technical assistance, knowledge, how they can adopt to build the right institution, for example, like strengthening the revenue collection, improving governance, capacity building, skill building, up to the level which is related to the decentralized, because many of the, especially big middle-income country, they are struggle with defining the right relationship between central or federal with the local government and making sure that they are able to deliver the public services for the people. So these are all things which is also important. Currently, if you talk about middle-income trap, also related to the climate change. I mean, because a lot of middle-income countries, they move from low to become middle-income because they urbanize. And the design of the urbanization the process as well as the city is actually creating quite a lot of this carbon as well as the climate change implication. Even in this case, if you talk about the adaptation and mitigation. So there are a lot of what you call it a threat that they are going to stuck at the middle income. But there is a lot of opportunity and knowledge, experience that can actually serve many middle income countries to avoid that trap through a good institutional building, learning to become more adept with the climate challenge, and nurturing the urbanization in a much more equal and sustainable way.
And the growing number of middle-income countries doesn't remove the fact that there are still a number of low-income countries which also need development cooperation, many of whom are fragile states. Mm-hmm. Do we need a different or distinct approach for fragile states in the way that we deliver aid and development cooperation there?
Yeah, I guess the fragile states definitely need a different, both the engagement, business model, as well as the commitment, because, I mean, from the World Development Report that we the World Bank just issued last year, the issue maybe related to job is the same, but the way you create job in a fragile and insecure, you need to establish the security first. So there are many of the messages which is actually giving us the lesson how to engage with fragile state. Long-term commitment, because it is actually, when you talk about security problem and fragile or weaknesses in the institutional level, it will take time, even more than a decade, for this institution to be built, for security to be then stabilized. And then you can at the same time design the right policy in order to create job and economic activity that will provide more prosperity. I think hands-on as well, hands-on involvement or engagement, technical assistance, sometimes you really have to really deal in a very intensive way how to really substitute the institution which is not yet there, or even if they are there, they barely function. That is, I think, the message from the involvement with fragile and conflict state.
Okay, and no matter whether you live in a rich country, a middle-income country, or a poor country at the moment, inequality seems to be a hot topic.
Yes.
Many people here at the CAPE conference are already talking about inequality. You mentioned the banks focused on inequality. Mm-hmm. Is inequality as important as poverty reduction these days in development?
Well, it is important, as you mentioned. It can threaten the achievement on the poverty side, even when you allow this inequality that then create social and as well as political destabilization on a country. So addressing the issue of inequality is very, very important, because the sense that measuring progress only through the growth and income per capita is not really telling more or less accurately the welfare of the people across group or income level in this. And many, as the middle income country is definitely there, because they are currently being seen as a successful developing country. But it doesn't mean that they are not actually dealing with this issue of inequality. In fact, many of them is actually struggling. Latin America, in Brazil, Mexico, has been known that the inequality was pervasive like 2 decades ago. They are doing a lot of policy correction, including intervening at a very poor level, and that says improving their Gini coefficient and creating more equal. So shared prosperity and addressing the issue inequality has become the theme of the bank, because it is not substituting the poverty eradication, but it's really making sure that when you support or the country design their policy in order to eradicate poverty, they cannot easily then going back to the poor level, but at the same time, then it can sustain more the progress being made.
Okay, and finally, you touched in your speech on the demands the taxpayer in rich OECD countries is placing on agencies involved in development, and you talked also about the changing demands of aid recipient countries and middle-income countries. What do these changing demands mean for an organization like the World Bank and its involvement in development cooperation?
Well, accountability and result is going to be like the theme. Because for the politician asking for the taxpayer money to be allocated for any development aids, for them, it's not only justifying from the political side why we have to allocate resource for this kind of activities. It is, of course, the belief about the international public good, collective development goals that will require a cross-border or beyond one country's own welfare improvement. But I think for many of this demand for both the shareholder or from the donor as well as the recipient will pressure institutions like us to be able first to be transparent about how we manage our business, to be efficient, to be able to tell the result rather than just the process or input. And that is a challenge in terms of the way the bank reform ourselves this time. The focus, for example, of creating transparency, simplifying the business process, be more flexible, agile, but at the same time still holding the principle, which is good collectively for the international community. I think that is the message. The result is definitely very important. We innovate on an instrument like, for example, program for result, which is actually we only pay when there is really an output or outcome achieved. But that's not only that, because beyond or below this kind of headline of result, there is really a message about capacity building, ownership, sustainability. It is there. So for us, message and the time is now to show to the international audience, whether you are on donor side, whether you are on recipient side, stakeholder wide, that we are an institution which is truly owned worldwide. We are governed and managed efficiently. We're focusing on results so the value for money can be justified politically.
Sri Maliani, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Nkosana Mweu, Executive Chairman of the Mandela Institute for Development Studies. We're at the CAPE 2012 conference looking at development cooperation in tomorrow's world. You spoke on the opening session this morning, gave some very interesting insights and perspectives. One of the first things you said was that you're not sure that the statistics which people produce in relation to Africa's performance over the last decade are actually matched on the ground. So what is your assessment of Africa's progress in the last decade or so?
Just to put it into context, thank you very much for talking to me. I pointed out to people that when the North African Revolution started happening, they started in Tunisia, and I was in Tunis right through, and that all of us in the development world were giving Tunisia top marks for achievement in this space, and all of a sudden this thing blew up in our faces. And what we've since gotten to understand is that those gross numbers or aggregate numbers do not really tell you what's going on at the micro level to individuals and to communities and so on, and that's what happened to the youth. The youth, although the country was performing well in terms of those development statistics, clearly the youth were not participating in this. So that was a major lesson. And I also, as an aside and almost as a joke, I quoted a professor who talked to me 2 days ago, who said, you know, between himself and Bill Gates, the average net worth was $18 billion. And then he laughingly said, I can assure you I do not have that kind of money. In other words, again, that's an example of what numbers, how numbers can be meaningless. Lastly, the reason why I made that point as an African is that in the last decade, when you look at publications, Africa is credited with having performed very well. And yeah, even the way Africa withstood the crisis and rebounded, in fact, and how quickly out of the crisis, at aggregate level looks incredibly impressive. But for a start, the problem is this. Today, Africa is 54 countries. And these numbers are averages. And I did mention that I travel within Africa a lot. And when I travel within Africa, what I see on the ground and these numbers do not match. So I was just putting out a health warning out there that, yes, by all means, that's what we have in terms of statistics, but let's be a bit more careful in terms of how we interpret them, what they mean, what they don't tell us, and what we should try go and find out.
And one of the other themes that's being discussed today is the growth in the number of actors in development finance or development cooperation. Yeah. A developing country today has far more options about where to access finance to meet their own development needs than they've had previously. Yeah. This presents opportunities, but obviously needs careful consideration. What do you think developing countries who do face increased options should be thinking about right now?
Yeah. Let's again go back. You say options. One of the things that has always been recognized now for quite some time in development cooperation is the load that development partners, if they are not careful, impose on recipient countries that already have got very limited capacity for managing. So if you've got 10 development partners coming to country X, and each one of those 10 He's got individual and different requirements of how to engage. This poor country, which is supposed to be getting development assistance, all of a sudden, actually, is being completely swamped in terms of attention. The civil servants, instead of paying attention to the job that they're supposed to be doing, they spend all their time writing reports for the development cooperation partners. And this has been recognized for quite some time now. And so there's been a move for a while now about harmonization, what is called harmonization, simply meaning that development partners interacting with a particular recipient country or community should attempt as much as possible to get together and develop one instrument of interaction with that recipient country. Now, the danger, therefore, in this proliferation of development cooperation partners is that if they, as incidental, who are they? So you've got the traditional ones in terms of where the aid is normally come from traditionally. We've got new ones like China. Then we've got non-state foundations and philanthropists also coming to the table. And their point of departure is very, very different because of the way who they've got to go and account to. Yeah? And because of that difference, their demands in terms of how they are going to interact with the recipient countries is much more likely to be different. So one has to say, you are right, in theory, there is more options in terms of where the resources for supporting development are coming from. But there is a much higher risk of literally paralyzing the systems of the recipient countries. So it's a very delicate balance that needs to be managed quite carefully.
And part of the title of the conference, Development in Tomorrow's World, in 10, 20 years' time, what is the biggest change you would like to see in development, cooperation, development, financing?
I would like to see, and again, I'll be quite graphic about this, the way I perceive development cooperation. You know, in English, in your language, you say, when you want to help somebody, it's better to teach them how to fish rather than give them fish. Okay? And for me, that's a general trend I'd like to see, and let me explain why. If you go to a country, country X, and give them support to build clinics or hospitals and schools, but don't give them support to develop their own economy in order for that economy to be able to carry the load of social spending, what you've actually done in the short to medium term is to increase their vulnerability. And we've seen, unfortunately, a couple of examples of this. We've seen it in Malawi. We've seen it, at the moment, I think it's actually an ongoing issue with Rwanda. Good intentions engage, facilitate the development of these social institutions, and then something goes wrong, either because you, the source of the funding, you have your own problems and you start pulling back in terms of the availability of that funding. What happens to what you built out there becomes actually a burden, because their own economy hasn't got the strength to carry those obligations. So what I would like to see is a much more conscious and deliberate effort to skew things towards helping economies become more robust, and almost as a secondary issue for those economies to then have their own capacity to spend putting money into their social institutions. That's what I would like to see.
And just very quickly, finally, can you tell me a bit about the role that the Mandela Institute for Development Studies will be playing in this?
Making people aware of the dangers of this, the first type of intervention, and pointing out why it's preferable to develop the robustness of their own economies in order to become less vulnerable.
Dr. Moyo, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Professor Li Zhaoyong, Dean of the China Agricultural University and Professor in Development Studies. Professor Zhaoyong, one of the things that people are talking about at this CAPE 2012 conference on development cooperation in tomorrow's world is trying to assess the impact of China as a development cooperation player. What, in your experience, is the difference? Is China different to a traditional aid donor? And if so, how?
I actually don't think completely what China has provided to other developing countries are entirely different from what OECD members. If you look for the modalities, areas, and distribution of the development assistance to different fields, and you compare what China did and what OECD did, you find a lot of similarities in terms of distribution of the region, in terms of areas like agriculture, health, and all those things. You can find a lot of these, you know, a lot of similarities. The other reason why, you know, the similarities, because China and the OECD, most of OECD and all the OECD members are in common in terms of eradicating global poverty and coping with the global challenge like climate change or environment. You know, China shares a lot in common with the rest of the world. So I wouldn't say that difference, big difference. But I do see there are many differences in terms of its way of delivering its aid, in the way in the countries where China actually concentrated, and always you find really a lot of differences. And for the difference, the reason why difference is reflected what China actually emphasizes on international development strategy, and that reflected Chinese own economic, social, economic, political conditions, and that also reflected political, social, economic conditions of the non and of the OECD members. So that actually makes difference between China and OECD members. Yeah.
One of the most striking things from your contribution this morning was a graph which you put up, which suggests that China is giving a greater percentage of its aid to low-income countries than the OECD countries. Is this part of a conscious strategy?
China has been always claiming that to help the poorest countries in the world is China's primary objective is for aid. And the data, actually distribution of the aid data, indicate quite clearly that and that respond to the overall strategy in terms of China's international development commitment. Yeah.
And just finally, we're talking about development cooperation in tomorrow's world. In the next decade, the next 20 years, what is the big change that you would like to see, that you anticipate, that will make the biggest difference to the way we conceive development cooperation today?
And in the future, I would say that the internet, the development system will actually should actually support economic growth first, and to help reducing inequality second, and I consider and then to cope with climate change and environment issue in the third, and those three issues, and I consider are faced by low income country, middle income country, and the global community. In doing so, and there are need of kind of a coalition, not in terms of organization institutionally, but in terms of political commitment and even somehow the financial commitment. And that commitment, I would say there are many ways, many international and many institutional and organization mechanisms available currently, looking for the G20 and looking for the UN and other kind of things, you know, and how to work with international regional organizations and things, and in the future will be very difficult, will be quite tough task in the future to actually cope with those three challenges.
Shuei Bukasu, Director in the Department of International Relations and Cooperation for the Government of South Africa. Shuei, what will South African aid look like?
I think it's a very interesting question. The overall strategy for the development agency, which is one that is emerging still, has not been approved. So note there might be some changes. Is one in which we want to ensure that the work we do fits in with the priorities either of partner countries or our regional organizations like the AU and SADC. So clearly the first element of that aid is, or development cooperation, let's put it that way, is around co-crafting the areas in which we get involved in with our partners. Secondly, we're looking to improve on the delivery mechanisms of our development cooperation, ensuring that there's proper coherence in our approach, ensuring that it is aligned to the country systems, looking at having proper methodologies for program development, project management, those kind of things. So we want to sharpen the delivery mechanism. The third element is then to broaden the instruments. that we use. And perhaps here we can have some discussion about this. Traditionally, on the African Renaissance Fund, it's been purely grant fund in one type. Applicants make, we have an application for grant funding, and we either approve it or not approve it. And many of our partner departments have been doing some kind of technical or other cooperation, but often this has not been coordinated. So under SACPA, our attempts now are to broaden these instruments, firstly to create many different types of partnerships, bilateral, multilateral partnerships, trilateral, which is usually a country of the north, a developed country with high levels of income, together with an emerging economy like South Africa, with somebody doing a project in a country that has a lower economic income. But we're also looking to build what we call multi-partner partnerships, in which we can have several partners working together on a project, and these partners need not all be from government departments or agencies. They could be from the private sector, they could be from NGOs, they could be from civil society, they could be development banks, they could be many different types of partnerships. And I think the idea is that based on what the needs are of a particular country or a project or a program, we need to find the right mix, policy mix, of how we approach that solution and the kind of instruments we need and kind of partners we need to deliver that project. So that's the one part on the instruments. The second one is that we're going to widen the kind of instruments that we use. Instead of just grants, we're looking to look at micro grant funding, which we will hopefully use through our embassies and helping them build capacity as well. There's a wide range of technical cooperation that we're going to approve. And then in partnerships with commercial interests, we would use our funding as grant elements to loans or joint ventures or PPPs. We think that we can enhance what they do, and especially in areas where there are risk or where feasibility has not been proven or those kind of things. So we've broadened those kind of instruments. The third element here is that the types of support could range from budgetary support to program, project, sectors, or even pooled funding or basket funding, as they call it. So we've created a great deal of flexibility around it. So the framework that we are developing is one that creates flexibility for different types of modalities for aid, but in which we are embedding very clearly practices for good governance, quality assurance, monitoring, evaluation, etc. So that's the overall approach.
Okay, and today's conference is looking at development cooperation in tomorrow's world. Old puzzles, new pieces. I'm sure South Africa is a new piece in this circumstance, rather than an old puzzle. What has been the most interesting thing that's been talked about today for you? What's given you the most food for thought?
I think I've attended several conferences like this, and usually we're trying to find, or we're arguing about, or discussing, what is different between South-South and North-South cooperation. And oftentimes we're trying to understand what is South-South cooperation, what does it bring to the table, and what are the advantages, and how can the traditional donors learn from this. And that's basically been the approach. But the interesting thing in today's discussion, very early on, was people saying, but hold on, these are not mutually exclusive processes. These are not mutually exclusive methods. Yes, there are differences, but there are also many, many similarities. And I think one of the responses I got to the presentation I made was that, well, it's almost as though South Africa's approach has all the principles of the traditional donors. And I said, yes, it's true, because our own legislation demands that we have issues of accountability and transparency and good M&E, etc. We don't dispute that. Where we have some differences, perhaps, is that we're not going to prescribe, as South African, that we're going to get involved in this sector or that sector. We're going to look at what are the needs and base our cooperation on whether or not we can make a contribution to that. And if so, exactly what that contribution can be. So I've seen a more convergence on what is the same or what are similarities between what we do, rather than emphasizing the differences. And I've seen that as an interesting part. I think traditional donors would also begin to see, if they are needs driven, that there is a need in particular in Africa for trade and foreign direct investment and for transfer of technology and for capacity building, rather than just grant aid in particular small projects. And I think if we can get that message across, that Africans themselves have set certain priorities, have identified areas in which they need aid. The African Development Platform has identified very specific areas as well. So I think, for me, this has been the interesting discussion around this, and there seems to be some kind of convergence in thinking. And we hope that as South Africa we're playing a role, or we can play a role, in creating this kind of convergence, that the two approach is not mutually exclusive, you know.
And I know that it's early days, and looking into tomorrow's world, maybe in 5, 10, 15 years' time, do you have an idea of what the role is you'd like to see South Africa's development partnership playing?
I think it's a very difficult question to answer. You know, any number of things can happen between today and tomorrow that can change this entire landscape. But I think if things are as they are, we'd like to be seen as an agency that is innovating around development cooperation to create new ways of doing things that meet the needs of our partner countries. And we would like to be, well, in some ways we want to have a smaller agency in 15 years' time, because it means that the needs have been addressed. So we're hoping that in 15 or 20 years' time there'll be less need for aid, there's more cooperation in many ways where there's mutual benefit. I would like to see in 15 years' time that South Africa has played a meaningful role in bringing about conditions where there's less dependency amongst African countries and other countries, developing countries, on aid and from outside, and that they're actually self-sufficient. So that's what we would like to see. Well,
Romilly Greenhill, Research Fellow in the Centre for Aid and Public Expenditure here at ODI. Romilly, we're two-thirds of the way through the Cape Conference now, and there's been plenty of talk, particularly yesterday, around development cooperation and how it's changing. What's been your assessment of the discussion so far?
I think there's two things that really came out very strongly yesterday, and around which there seemed to be quite a lot of consensus. The first is around changing the goals of development cooperation, to recognise it's not just about poverty reduction or eradication, as previously understood, but there's actually a wider set of goals around environmental sustainability, economic growth, also financial stability has been mentioned quite strongly. So I think that's the first big thing, that we really need to move away from this very poverty-focused paradigm that we've had up until now. And I think related to that, there's been quite a consensus around needing to find better ways of measuring the contribution that different actors are making to achieving these goals. And quite striking has been some acceptance that we may need to open up the ODA definition, which is politically potentially quite controversial and potentially quite risky, but actually people were recognising we need better ways of measuring and monitoring the contribution of all these actors to a wider set of goals, and therefore we need new definitions for development cooperation.
And we've had contributions from plenty of middle-income countries, and lots of talk about the growing number of middle-income countries, and particularly talk about how that category is getting so broad now that there are so many countries in different positions within that pigeonhole that actually a lot of them are working together to solve their own problems. Is that something that we'd like to see more of?
Absolutely, and I think that doesn't just apply to middle-income countries. I think some of the words that have come out have been around horizontality, mutuality, the fact that we're moving away from a world in which the rich north is giving to the poor south. It's actually about different countries contributing in whichever ways they can to solve these global problems, and that, you know, even rich countries have needed support, for example, in the recent financial crisis. So I think it's very much about working together to provide support in whichever ways countries can do so to meet the global needs.
And A lot of these countries, some of them are now even developing their own development agencies. Your work looks at the options available to countries looking to meet their own development needs, particularly at a country level. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. One of the key findings from the research, which is actually corroborated by the discussion yesterday, was that more choice at country level has often been seen as a really positive thing. Some of the global literature is all very nervous about, you know, the growth of China and the non-DAC donors. But actually at country level, countries are really valuing that new choice that they have. And I think there have been some problems of making the kind of aid effectiveness agenda, which is really about ownership and alignment, making that happen. And I think what our research is suggesting is that it's going to happen by default now. If countries are in a stronger position, if they can negotiate between the different actors and the different providers, they can actually play a stronger role in financing their own development, which I think is what we all agree is really critical.
Simon Maxwell, Senior Research Associate at ODI. Simon, we're at the CAPE 2012 conference on development cooperation in tomorrow's world. You've been part of that conference. I've seen you on the edge of your seat on a couple of occasions looking to respond to some of the comments which have been made. I saw one particular on climate finance. Can you tell us what you were thinking at that moment?
Well, you know, I completely accept, buy into, and have been a proponent of the idea that development cooperation has to change. And I talk about having the same mission statement for development cooperation, but a new job description, because we all believe in poverty reduction and human development and so on, but we're going to be doing different things in the future in new ways. You know, as we have the conversation, and especially in a conference like this, people use stylized facts a lot. They kind of have memorable things you might know about the aid system. And some of those are right, and some of them are actually rather deeply misleading. I think there's a stylized fact, for example, that climate finance is very different to old-style aid because it deals much more with the private sector. In the climate field, we talk a lot about blending loans and grants, about incentivizing the private sector, using risk instruments, and so on and so forth. Well, you know, we do a lot of that as well in aid, and there's a long tradition. For example, the Commonwealth Development Corporation, CDC, or the IFC of the World Bank, working with the private sector, taking equity stakes in businesses, the IFC, and making sure that we find some way to, at the lowest cost possible, incentivize the private sector. So I think there's a real convergence there between aid and climate finance. There are a couple of other of these stylized facts that have had me on the edge of my seat. One is the idea that you can divide aid into two categories. There's country programmable aid, and there is everything else. And the only one that matters is country programmable aid, which is made available to the government that they can put in their budget. I think that's a really important distinction to make if you're working on issues like budget support and how to provide large-scale program aid to countries. But it kind of implies that other forms of aid are worthless. And the other forms of aid include humanitarian aid, absolutely vital for protecting lives, but also actually for investing in resilience and helping people to bridge relief and development. It also implies that technical assistance is somehow almost immoral, is unnecessary and inappropriate. And of course it's true that that puts the money back into the sending country rather than the receiving country. But some of the best aid is often technical assistance. You know, I remember somebody saying to me once that in Zambia, the best single aid project ever was paying the salary of an advisor to the governor of the central bank. Technical assistance, but it actually made macroeconomic stability in Zambia easier. There are some other big stylized facts about the growing importance of the philanthropic sector. It's very important to have those numbers right to make sure we don't include, for example, lots of cultural aid or aid to Israel, which is for religious purposes. But there are some things you can do with philanthropic aid and some things you can't. I've asked in the past, why doesn't Melinda make motorways and build bridges? They don't. They do other things. They do health and education and so on. So we can't assume that the rise of philanthropic aid and peer-to-peer giving is going to be going to substitute perfectly for traditional aid. I'm really in favour of the debate. This is a great conference. But when we use stylized facts, let's use them carefully.
And your comment on climate finance reflects some of the importance which has been placed on those issues in the discussions over the last day or so. That's just one part, and you touched briefly on another, philanthropy, of an emerging aid architecture which is up for discussion. What's your overview on how the aid architecture is changing.
Oh, there are a couple of things to say about that. First of all, aid is going to be under pressure. And it may also be the case that traditional aid is less needed. And here's one of the issues that I worry about a lot, that we're going to say that middle-income countries don't need aid. In fragile states, it's really difficult to spend aid. And then there is a small number of kind of not fragile, low-income countries, and we're going to pile into those countries, and we may run into real problems of absorptive capacity. I often say there are three kinds of countries. There are middle-income countries that don't need aid, there are fragile states where we can't spend aid, and there's Malawi. And we know that if you try to provide more than sometimes as much as 40%, but that's a high estimate of aid as a share of GNP to developing countries, they run into serious problems of absorptive capacity. If we find that we don't need as much aid for the low-income countries as we traditionally think we have, then we're going to find some difficulty in maintaining public support for 0.7. And that raises very difficult and important issues about the extent to which we count climate finance and aid for other global public goods as aid. Historically, we've always argued for additionality of climate finance, and I think at the moment that is still the right thing to do. The previous government in the UK set a limit of 10% of aid that could be used for climate purposes. If we lift that limit, and many countries are doing so, then we may find that all the aid that we have available is gobbled up by climate finance, and the risk is that we are taking money away from young mothers and children in Burkina Faso and giving it to producers of solar panels in a country like China.
And talking about tomorrow's world, 10, 20 years' time, in your view, where should aid and development cooperation be? How should we have evolved in that time?
Well, I'm clear in my mind that whatever happens to traditional aid to low-income countries, there will be a large and growing need for international action to deal with a set of global public bads, starting with climate, but lots of others, including global disease threats, crime and drugs and terrorism and security and so on and so forth. We're going to need cooperation to deal with those, and we're going to need money to help deal with them, either directly or as part of a negotiation with developing countries. There are a couple of features then of the international development system that follow from that observation. The first is that the solutions to global problems are necessarily multilateral. We've often made a case against the proliferation of bilateral agencies and funds and programs simply on the grounds of the transactions costs for developing countries. But there's a new argument for multilateralism, which is that you're not going to be able to deal with climate on a country-by-country basis. We need the global deals. We need the multilateral institutions, whether it's the UN or the World Bank or the WTO, or the UNFCCC on climate, for example. So the people working in aid in the future will be necessarily looking to the multilateral system at least as much as they are to the bilateral system. And that has big implications for the organisation of agencies and for the staffing of agencies, and I've written about that quite a bit in the past as well. We will still need people who understand about how villages work in the poorest countries and about social relationships and so on, but we're also going to need a lot of people who know much more about how the international system works and how to broker global deals. I remember once speaking to a group of social anthropologists and saying that you have extraordinary expertise in the marriage customs of tribal communities in Bangladesh. What we're going to need in the future is similar expertise applied to the marriage customs of members of the General Assembly, because that's where the focus will be of our development work in the future.
Andrew Steer, President of the World Resources Institute. Andrew, we're coming towards the end of the CAPE 2012 conference on development cooperation in tomorrow's world. One of the things which has been identified as an aspect of tomorrow's world is the emergence of climate finance. You spoke yesterday about what that means for development finance. Is it fair to characterise climate finance as a threat to development finance?
Well, what climate finance is trying to do is make development more possible and prevent possible backward trends. I do think, however, in the current constrained financial environment, some countries will be tempted to take money out of what was for traditional and wonderful poverty reduction and put it into climate finance, take it out of low-income countries, put it into middle-income countries. I think that is a threat. I think that would be a great pity. Now, what we need to do is build a case for continued high levels of poverty-reducing aid. At the same time, we're going to need a larger pot of money overall, and we're not yet doing a very convincing job of demonstrating the need for ODA. Those who are advocating climate finance are currently doing a better job than those who are advocating ODA.
And in your opinion, what can climate finance as a relatively new form of finance learn from development cooperation or aid, which has been around for a while? And can development cooperation learn anything from climate finance?
Well, certainly those who are responsible for climate finance, and of course the term climate finance is defined differently by different people. It includes grants from government, but it includes carbon markets, and many people would say it also includes foreign investment of private companies in green technologies. The plain fact of the matter is the painfully learned lessons of ODA, of the Paris, Accra, and Busan agendas, need to be internalized pretty quickly into those who are responsible for climate finance, especially the official part. At the same time, I think those who are responsible for traditional ODA could learn a lot from those involved in climate finance. There's a much greater political dialogue and enthusiasm about climate finance right now. It's a much buzzier space altogether. There's much more energy in figuring out issues such as how to leverage private money. In climate finance, for example, one of the hottest things that's discussed is how can we use a minimum amount of public grant money in order to achieve the maximum amount of impact on the ground. That's not the way that traditional ODA people have looked at it. And so I actually think that there's some very, very interesting debates to be had on traditional ODA. I mean, obviously, the excitement around Monterey 10 years ago or around Glen Eagles in 2005, that has gone. We need to reinvigorate that. The exciting space is now often in the climate world, and so we need to balance that if we're going to get not just to 0.7, but above that.
And many people share an optimistic assessment of the role of poverty reduction efforts in reducing poverty. Do you have an optimistic assessment of the ability of climate finance to address climate adaptation needs?
Well, first, I absolutely share the optimistic view of ODA, and we have to fight against the argument that would say, hey, the last 20 years have been the most successful in history with regard to poverty reduction, therefore the money that we've devoted to that can now be switched over to climate. What we should be saying is because we've been so successful, we now know how to spend money very well on poverty, and we need to spend even more on that. Am I as optimistic about climate finance? Yes, I actually think if you look to see where money is being spent, public money is being spent today on climate change, you're seeing very, very good returns on the mitigation side. Part of the reason is an obsession about results. Climate finance obsessed about results long, long before those doing traditional ODA. And of course, it's because it's easier because you've got a unit of account, which is a ton of carbon. Much more difficult, of course, on the adaptation side. Intellectually, we've come a long way on the mitigation side in terms of we know how to model it, we know how to look at cost effectiveness, we know how to look at the impacts on the economy. We're probably 8 years behind on adaptation. Even the definition of resilience still needs to be worked upon. And just as the banking system, 20 years ago, invented the idea of stress tests to try and figure out how resilient is a balance sheet. We need something like that to capture the public imagination so we don't have New York City's suffering $70 billion of costs as they may well have done in the case of the hurricane last week.
And just finally, you've had a few months now to get to grips with your new role as president of the World Resources Institute. What is it you hope to bring to the table on these issues?
Well, the World Resources Institute is a wonderful institution. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary. We bring serious data and analysis to the table. We then create space for stakeholders, the private sector, governments, communities, civil society, to engage. We have had wonderful successes in the past. We're the keepers of the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, for example. We created the Millennial Ecosystem Survey. We catalyzed the existence of the GEF. We have some wonderful product lines. And what we want to do is bring facts in real time to the people who have to make decisions, and that is whether they are heads of state, ministers, whether they're heads of corporations, whether they are communities. We've long passed the time, unfortunately, when governments alone can be relied upon. The Rio Plus 20 demonstrated to us, you know, in convincing fashion that simply government to government no longer, if ever, it did solve problems. We need creative coalitions. And what WRI is very good at, because of our deep and long association with the major financial and commercial and manufacturing industries and the private sector, together with governments, together with civil society, we want to be part of this new era of sort of mini-multilateralism or plurilateralism, with really clearly established goals, identifying leaders, supporting them, and then building coalitions for scaling up.
Jonathan Glennie, Research Fellow in ODI's Centre for Aid and Public Expenditure, now based in Bogota. Johnny, the fact that you're based in Colombia means you've been central to the part of the conference which has involved Latin American countries, been talking about South-South cooperation. Can you give us a view on the discussions that we've heard in the last couple of days?
I think it's a bit slightly contradictory, because on the one hand, emerging countries and the arrival on the scene and the fact that they're setting up new aid agencies has revolutionised development, different ways of thinking, a more horizontal approach, possibly in general, different attitude to the public sector, experience within their own lifetimes of working on extreme poverty. So in a sense, it is revolutionary. But my case really is that there isn't that as much difference as people sometimes make out between so-called South-South cooperation and, I suppose, what otherwise would be North-South cooperation or traditional DAC aid. And I think the most important thing to remember is that the purpose that this money is given is not just charitable, but very much political. Everyone's got their own interests at heart, as well as having solidarity with poorer countries at heart. And it's a complex balance. But I think the fact that we look at the new providers and analyse them is holding up a mirror to traditional aid donors and asking some really helpful questions.
Much of Latin America falls into the very broad middle-income country category, which we've heard is growing. Sri Mulyani kicked off the conference talking about these classifications: low-income country, middle-income country, high-income country. She said that graduations are often painful from low-income to middle-income when they should be a celebration. Mm. How useful are these categories?
Well, it's interesting because I wrote a paper last year suggesting that these categories had really run their course. And Sri Mulyani's colleague, Martin Ravalian, who's the director of research at the World Bank, just said something last week, and I think next week he's actually coming to ODI to say something similar. Basically, that the LIC, MIC, HIC categories are arcane. In my view, at least, the focus on average income is limited. It doesn't say very much. It's important, but it's limited in what it says about poverty and development. Most importantly, the cut-off points are entirely arbitrary. We have no real idea why they were made at that level. And the idea that countries moving from $1,000 per capita income to $1,050, $1,100 per capita income, that should suddenly change the way we do aid, I think is quite unhelpful. And actually quite stingy. We shouldn't be just trying to help countries move from really extremely poor to just very poor. We should be, I think, having an ambition slightly greater than that, helping countries move to really a developed status.
And lastly, the theme of the conference is to look at development cooperation in tomorrow's world. Can you give us an idea of what in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time, on the basis of what you've heard in the last few days, we can be expecting to see from development cooperation?
The current era, the current global era, is defined by two major themes. Firstly, the emergence of the new powers, the total geopolitical rebalancing, which of course therefore has its impacts on development and aid. And secondly, and equally importantly, the realization that we live within planetary limits, resource limits, and this refocus on sustainable development. It's not something that we were so aware of in the 50s and 60s when the development project started. And I think that those two issues are going to define the next 20 years. And there's a third one that's worth remembering. Not quite so transformational. It's rather a swing back. But it's a swing back from an over-focus on the market, on the private sector, really some neoliberal exaggeration, towards a recognition that the public sector is equally important in development as the private sector, that has an incredibly important role to play. And I think that that realization will stand us in good stead for the future. And that's why I'm toying with this idea of what I'm calling a global public sector to replace our language about aid. And my hope is that the general publics of North countries and South countries will all recognize that there's a public sector at the national level for policing, for parks, for investments in research, for incentivizing private investment. And so there should be at a global level, the more that we aspire to be a group of countries in the world all working together.
These conversations were carried out at the 2012 CAPE conference, Old Puzzles, New Pieces, Development Cooperation in Tomorrow's World. If you'd like more information about the conference or any of the publications published subsequently, please visit www.odi.org.uk/CAPE2012. Thank you.